From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm filling in for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. On today's show, I speak with New York Times Magazine Washington correspondent Hedrick Smith. He says the rules of the game in Washington have completely changed, and he's written a book about it. Also today, I speak with British novelist Faye Weldon. Her new book is a fable about the power of good and evil and the relationships of women and men. Turning to classical music, Lloyd Schwartz reviews the Tallis Scholars, a British octet specializing in Renaissance choral music. And singing also appeals to humorist Alice Kahn, but in her case, those who can't dream. That's all ahead on today's Fresh Air. New York Times reporter Hedrick Smith says that when he first came to Washington, D.C. as a correspondent 25 years ago, he thought he understood how Washington worked. After covering the administrations of six presidents, starting with John Kennedy, Smith says that now everything has changed, especially the rules governing how Washington works. In his new book, The Power Game, Smith likens politics in Washington to a game with new power maneuvers and some unlikely players and winners, a game that citizens and power brokers must understand if they want to succeed in the new Washington. Hedrick Smith is currently the Washington correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. During his more than 25 years at the Times, he served as Washington bureau chief, deputy national editor, and has covered events in Cairo, Vietnam, Paris, and Moscow. His Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting from the Soviet Union later led to his book, The Russians. He also was part of the team of reporters that released the story of the Pentagon Papers in 1971. Smith is frequently seen on the TV show Washington Week in Review. I spoke with Hedrick Smith from the National Public Radio Bureau in New York. I asked him how the analogy of a game popped into his head when he wrote his new book on how Washington works.
Can't really say exactly when or how. I was looking for, I guess, and I always have as a reporter, whether working in Washington or overseas, looking for patterns in what was happening. I was trying to understand why some people succeed, why some people fail, trying to get a metaphor to explain to people who are a long ways away from Washington, who don't follow it real closely, but who want to understand what's going on, trying to get a metaphor for them to suggest that it's almost like Monopoly or some kind of board game where there are moves. You know what to do in Monopoly. You know, you land on a certain number of squares and you buy up the property and you build houses and you build hotels, and there's certain ways in which you play the game. There's a strategy. And I think that's very true of Washington, whether you're working on a committee in Congress, or whether you're a lobbyist, or whether you're a staff member at the White House, or whether you're a member of the cabinet, you begin to know there's certain smart ways to play the game. And if you play the game that way and you understand that there, in fact, is a game going on, and I don't mean that as a put down, but that there are these patterns, you will do well. And if you, and it doesn't matter whether you're a liberal or a conservative, a Democrat or a Republican, but if you don't understand the game, particularly the big games, because there's more than one game going on. There's a whole Olympiad of games. If you don't understand those games, you won't do well. You can go out, and, as Jimmy Carter did, and win a lot of primaries and get the Democratic nomination and become president. And then if you arrive with a bunch of advisors from Georgia like Jody Powell and Ham Jordan and Stu Eisenstadt and Burt Lance and all those guys, but you don't make your links with the networks in Washington and the power centers in Washington, and you don't understand the game, then your political victory out on the campaign trail among the people will not pay off.
So after all these years in Washington, you've become a sports writer.
Yeah, actually, I think there's a lot in political writers that is like sports writing. There is an ebb and flow to the game. There's a momentum to it. You know, you watch a tennis match, or you watch a football game, or even you watch a high diver diving and get psyched for the event, and you can sense the momentum change sometimes when people are competing against each other. Somebody makes a bad shot, and they kind of get off. Or you sense the moments of climax and drama. Politics is like that. It is an emotional contest. Substance matters a great deal. And I don't want to say that it doesn't. Issues matter a great deal. I talk in the Power Game about the way in which, under Franklin Roosevelt, the intellectual initiative, the policy initiative, shifted to the Democrats. And under Ronald Reagan, when he came in 1980, the intellectual initiative shifted to the Republicans. So substance does matter. But the way in which you play the game with the other players and the skills of sporting skills, almost, if you will, are very important, too.
When did you notice that the rules of the game had changed in Washington?
You know, I didn't notice as it was going on as much as I noticed after the fact. And I go back and I really date it to 1974. And one of the fun things for me and what was so fascinating in doing the reporting as well as the writing on this book was the personal discoveries that I went through, taking time off from the New York Times and working full time, was how important 1974 and the early 70s were. That was a watershed. There was a political earthquake that took place in that year and the years right around it. And a lot of people identify that with Watergate, but that isn't really the story. The story was before Watergate and has lasted long after Watergate. What happened was there were shocks to the political system. The Democrats, the liberal Democrats particularly, in the House of Representatives, had become frustrated with the old entrenched Southern Democratic chairman of the powerful committees on Armed Services and Taxes, the House Ways and Means Committee, and lots of other committees, and they wanted to shake them out of power. What happened as a result of Watergate was a lot of Republican congressmen lost, and a whole new crop of Democratic congressmen came in, 75 brand new Democratic congressmen, and they provided the shock troops for reform, and they threw out a bunch of the old senior Democratic committee chairmen. They changed the rules of the House, they stripped the old power barons of a lot of their power, and they spread power out around the House. And at the same time, the House and the Senate together challenged the White House. They passed the War Powers Resolution, actually the year before. They passed the Budget Act, and Congress began to feel its oats against the presidency. And it set up its own budget office, and it took on the trappings of power. The size of the staff in Congress began to increase. It went from something like 10,000 back in the mid-70s to over 20,000, 25,000 today. And that, along with that, the committees proliferated. The number of lobbyists went up something like a few hundred back in the early 60s to 20,000 or so today. The number of lawyers shot up from 11,000 to 40,000 plus today. The number of journalists multiplied. Everything became bigger, complex, and much harder to run. And that's when it happened, right there. And we really didn't stop and pay attention to that because we were so obsessed with Watergate. But if you look at what's going on now, you got to go back and see the roots of it right back then.
In school, a lot of us learned that the power shifts from the president to Congress, you know, checks and balances.
Right.
Has all that changed?
No, that's there, but that's rather a simplistic model. My feeling is that power floats. What you're suggesting is almost a teeter-totter. One's up and the other's down. It's binary, up or down, good or bad, the guys on the Hill or the guys in the White House. Actually, I think it floats. It shoots out more. For example, I have said, and will say again now, that probably the second most powerful person in the United States government at the moment is the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, who doesn't happen to sit at either end of Pennsylvania Avenue, but somewhere else entirely. And it was true back in 1982 when Paul Volcker was chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Also, that analogy of Congress versus the president, you usually associate Congress with the Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader. But if you think back to 1985, the famous Graham-Rudman budget bill, who were Graham and Rudman? They were two freshman Republicans, didn't appear on any organizational chart in any way in the old power game, and yet they got power. And they got power in part because the whole system is balkanized and broken up. They got power because they were geniuses at figuring out a good solution, or at least a temporary solution that looked good, and also because Phil Graham in particular was very good at marketing his political ideas on television. And what happens is some of the new players in the game, people like Al Gore and Dick Gephardt and Jack Kemp running for president and others too, have learned that if you can get a good idea, You can get it on the national television networks. It goes out to the public out around the country. People get interested. They start writing into their congressmen, calling in, and you get influence in Washington by bouncing ideas out off the country and back into the system. That's called outside politics. It's a totally different game from the old inside game of getting legislation passed by working quietly in the back halls and the corridors and the smoke-filled rooms. It's the new breed, the new politics, a totally different kind of game from the old game.
My guest is New York Times reporter Hedrick Smith. Well, what about you? What's your place in the game? How are you a player?
Well, obviously we in the press are players in the game because, in large part, the old system has been broken up. We have become the medium through which the politicians exercise a lot of their power. Television, even more than print journalism, gives politicians the platform to expound their ideas. The people who are executive producers of the morning talk shows or This Week or Face the Nation or Meet the Press are powerful in the sense that if they decide Senator X or a member of the cabinet Y, Schultz or Howard Baker or you name it, Don Regan or Senator Paul Simon or Albert Gore, goes on the air, they give those people a platform. And that is power, because that is the power of communication. It is also the image of power, because power is not only reality, not only position, but influence. And influence is visibility and the perception of power. If you are perceived to have power, you have power.
When I look at the new game as it's played in Washington from your view, I see fierce competition in every corner. Does that include you? Are you very competitive?
Well, sure, I'm competitive in trying to get stories for my paper ahead of other people or more importantly, to explain what's going on in a better way than other people. But I don't think that precludes other people in quite the same way as politicians who are vying for a particular position or who are vying to get certain pieces of legislation or certain policies approved. If you win the policy battle at this round, somebody else loses. I think if a journalist wins in the sense of doing a good job, it doesn't necessarily mean that other people lose. So I don't think we're in it quite the same way. But there's no question, we are important. The lobbyists are important. The people who raise money are important. One of the thrills of our system is that power is as split up and as fragmented as it is. But one of the problems is it's very hard to lead. It's very hard to pull together. We lack the kind of cohesive forces that we used to have in our history up until, say, the presidency of Eisenhower, and then after that. The game has changed.
But who do you compete against? Do you feel like you're competing just against the other reporters, or do you feel like you're personally competing against the politicians too?
No, I don't feel it. I mean, there's no question that there's a struggle in the sense that if I'm dealing with somebody, say, in the national security area, and I want to get at what our real policy is or what the policy debate is in the National Security Council. And by the way, in this book, this is one of the things that I tried to do most, was to take people right directly into the situation room where Reagan is sitting around the table with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the head of the CIA and Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense and the Arms Control Advisor, and exactly what they're debating. Well, if they're debating something in there and there's a disagreement, well, the administration may not want that information out, at least until they've made a decision, because other people could come to influence it. Members of the Senate, members of the public could try to influence the debate that's going on inside the administration. The people who are controlling policy want to control information. It's very important to control information to control policy. That's one of the rules of the power game, by the way. And so I'm going to be competing with those people in the sense that I am simply trying to get the information out to tell my readership, and my readership includes other power players as well as the general public. In that sense, yes. But basically, no, I'm not competing with politicians.
All right, let's get personal here.
Okay.
The scene in Washington goes on all day, of course, but it also goes on at night at all those influential parties. Do you go to many of them?
Not anywhere near as many as I used to, but I go to some.
Do you like them?
If they're involved with people that I enjoy, but I go most of the time, if and when I go working. I go thinking about what I'm doing and what I'm trying to report on.
Well, are they the source of many of your insider anecdotes?
No. I did 400 or 500 interviews, Faith, with people that I sat down with a tape recorder going and a notebook in my hand, And I think after a lot of years of reporting in Congress, I was surprised to find out how many people trusted me and were willing to talk to me either directly on the record or off the record. But no, you don't get full stories. And what I'm trying to tell here is full narrative stories. What you tend to get at parties like that are snippets, tips that you can follow up later on. You rarely get a full-blown story. Full-blown stories don't get landed in your lap. You have to work to dig them out step by step, chisel by chisel.
Well, what's the rule at these parties when you go? If someone walks up and tells you something really great, do you feel free to use it? Is it fair game?
No, I don't feel it's fair game. I'm in a social setting, and what I will do is call them the next day and say, you said last night, that we're going to run a mission to do this or that to some other country, or you said that Congressman Y has been stealing on the side and so forth. I would like to use that material. I would like to put that material on the record or at least on background. I'd like to be able to use it. And if somebody says no, I may try and go get that information somewhere else. But often I've been able to talk people into doing that. Sometimes they've said it quite knowingly that that's what I was going to do. Other times they've been caught off guard, and I've persuaded them that they weren't going to be able to sit on that information very long anyway. It was only a matter of time before other reporters would get it, and they might as well get a fair version, and they were going to get a fair shake from me, and I think I've got that reputation.
So is that true for all anecdotes that you get? Do you clear them all?
If I'm sitting in front of somebody taking notes, I don't bother to go back and clear. I mean, I think that they pretty well got to assume that I'm doing reporting. I mean, when I went around on this book, Faith, I sat down with Howard Baker, and I asked him about his relationship with Ronald Reagan. And he sat and told me that as he was sitting on the platform back in 1981, January 20th, when Ronald Reagan was taking the oath of office, making up his mind whether or not he was going to cooperate with Reagan or not. That may seem like a silly notion because he did cooperate with Reagan and he's now chief of staff in the White House. But back at that point, he had run against Reagan in 1980. He had backed Gerry Ford against Reagan in 1976. He wasn't sure he liked Reagan's economic policy. And he had the examples of earlier Republican majority leaders like Bill Noland of California under Eisenhower, who had been very independent. Now, he's sitting there describing that to me. That's a very intimate moment in his life, and a very important one, by the way, for Reagan's success and for the rest of us. And it's an important story. If I'm recording that and taking notes, I don't go back to him and say, can I use this? I'm a reporter. That's my business. He's got to assume that's what I'm doing. No, I mean, there are lots of things I find out from third parties, and I cross-check them. There are stories about what goes on in the White House Situation Room I just described. At one point, I talk about how Admiral Crow, the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said point-blank to Reagan, sitting in the Situation Room with the other top advisors of Ronald Reagan, that the arms proposals that he made to Gorbachev at Reykjavik were bad for this country, and the president should not put them on the table in Geneva. Now, I found that out from two people who were in that room. Mm-hmm. I did not go back and check out with other people whether or not I could use that anecdote. I got it from one person, and to be sure that somebody wasn't exaggerating or misleading me, I cross-checked it with somebody else. But as soon as I had two sources that satisfied me that I had an accurate version of it, I didn't go ask the president or the White House press secretary. I'd done my work as a reporter.
My guest is Hedrick Smith. He's the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He's also a frequent guest on the TV show Washington Week in Review. He has a new book titled The Power Game, How Washington Works. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is New York Times reporter Hedrick Smith. You've been in Washington through how many presidents is it?
I first came to Washington under John F. Kennedy in 1962. I've been in and out as a foreign correspondent in Moscow and Cairo, Paris and whatnot, but I've covered across six presidencies.
And how different have they been as far as getting information out of them?
Oh, they've differed quite a bit. The Nixon White House was a very tough White House to get information out of. The Carter White House and the Kennedy White House were more open. Johnson's White House started out fairly open, and then the further we got into Vietnam, the more embattled the White House got, the more difficult it was to get information. It's always more difficult to get information on national security policy and foreign policy than it is on domestic issues. But whenever an administration gets under fire, it gets tougher to get information, and Republican administrations tend to be a little bit tougher generally than Democratic.
Well, yeah, a lot has been said about the Reagan strategy, using TV to get a good image across. But with print, how have the Reagan team players tried to work you to get the right print image for the president?
Oh, I mean, they work print as hard as they work the television. Let me go back and remind you that early on in the Reagan presidency, Reagan did something very unusual. He reached out beyond his own normal campaign entourage after he got elected to pull people onto his White House staff who were not from his inner circle, the old California gang that he brought with him. And he had a number of people in the White House, including Ed Meese, who was then his presidential counselor, Mike Deaver, who was the deputy chief of staff and his main image man, and Jim Baker, who became chief of staff. And there were other people as well. But they became known as the Troika. And one of the ways in which they became known as a Troika, in fact, was that I wrote a magazine article in the spring of 1981, which was called The Reagan Troika. I had not known what the relative power positions of those people were. I wasn't sure what it was when I started out writing that article. They devoted quite a good deal of attention to letting me find out how they worked together and so forth, I think in order to shape that image that they were a team together. And most importantly, Mike Deaver, who was, as I say, the image guy there, helped arrange to make sure that a New York Times photographer got a good picture of the three of them together. That picture and that article, which I believe was accurate, I don't believe I was being used in the sense of being misled. I think I was finding out what was actually going on. But that article and that picture, talking about them as a Troika and using that word, imprinted that idea in the minds of a lot of print reporters and a lot of television reporters. And they used the print reporting, in this case mine, but they've used other people as well. They've worked with Lou Cannon of the Washington Post a great deal. He's gotten a lot of leaks and he's gotten a lot of insights, and Lou is an excellent reporter. They've used that kind of direct information with reporters who are aggressive, who are around the White House, who are pushing to get more information. This is not all a question of the White House making up the idea. I mean, I was pushing hard to get an insight into how the White House actually operated way back then. But in responding, they helped shape what was going to be the television coverage, because the television started blossoming with stories about the Reagan Troika after my article appeared.
Well, a lot's been written and said describing Mr. Reagan as the Teflon president. You know, nothing sticks. Is that frustrating to you? You lay out the facts and it doesn't stick.
Well, I don't think that it's the job of reporters, or reporters need to decide that they've got to make something stick against a president or not stick against a president. Our job is to try to find out what's going on and to tell the people straight and let the chips fall where they may. Obviously, Iran-Contra stuck on Reagan, and it's been a real problem for him, and it's been a blot on his presidency. And people tend to forget that back in 1982 and 1983, when the economy was going through a recession, Reagan had a very hard time. His public opinion polls went down. His image was not good. One of the things that tends to happen, and reporters need to remember this just as much as voters, when economic times are reasonably good, when inflation is down and there's growth in the economy and there's money in people's pocketbooks and in their wallets, they tend to be very forgiving towards whoever is in the White House, and particularly if that is a very likable person, as Ronald Reagan is. So I don't see that as our job, to nick and to wound a president. Our job is to go report, call the shots as they may, and let people respond.
You know, I was thinking that it must be hard as an insider for you to see Washington's political game, if you will, like an outsider. How do you manage that?
That's hard. In the first place, this is an inside Washington book. The whole point of this book is to take the zoom lens and bring it right in on Ronald Reagan talking with his people, on Tip O'Neill talking with his people, on Reagan and Pete Domenici, the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, arguing with each other on the phone, each side with aides telling them to tell each other something, on what goes on inside the National Security Council, on the way lobbyists work and how they go out and do grassroots work and how they strategize and literally how they put ads together and to influence people, to influence the Congress. This is an inside book. What I'm trying to do is to take people inside. But what I tried also to do, Faith, is to take the viewpoint of people outside of Washington, a long ways away, and imagine as if I were a foreign correspondent reporting on Washington and taking people into the city. Very often when I was actually writing the book, I would reach points in the stories that I was writing. And if there's any strength in this book, it is really in the stories that illustrate the main points that I'm trying to make. I would get to the point in these stories where I had to decide whether or not to give more detail that would be titillating to the insiders or less detail and more of a feel that the general public could relate to. And 9 times out of 10, I picked less detail to try to reach to the general public. That's how I try to deal with the problem.
This is New York Times reporter Hedrick Smith. When I remembered your book about the Russians and now this one on how Washington works, unlike the writers who like to take these small incidents and blow them up, you've taken these huge subjects. What appeals to you about that?
I'm an integrator. I'm an analyzer. I like to put things together. Faith, I took American history and literature as a major back in college. When I went to graduate school at Oxford, I took philosophy, politics, and economics. These are the kinds of courses that lead you towards broad generalization and towards trying to integrate and understand the whole phenomenon. You're right. It's almost crazy for a reporter to try to do the kind of book that I've done. I've tried to go into our government and do for government what Theodore White did for the political campaigns back with the 1960, the making of the president. Explain to you how the whole thing operates. Because I think people want the whole picture. It's you know, anybody can write a biography of one president. It's tough to do that, but that can be done. Or write a single issue. And I think people want to understand the whole thing. There are things I've left out here. I have not done the judiciary. I have not done a whole lot on the regulatory commissions. I took as big a topic as I dared, the normal political arena of Washington, and pulled it together.
But let me ask you, are you cynical at all after all this time in Washington, 20 years?
Well, I'm cynical about what people promise, and I'm cynical about what the public expects. But basically, I'm a pretty optimistic person. I'm disturbed at the endemic problems we have in our system, and I think people need to have them laid out. We don't have a level playing field, I think I said before, in the races for the House of Representatives. We have divided government and partisan government, and it's causing all kinds of frustration to the politicians and to the people. Our presidential campaigns don't fit with governing. What you do in order to get elected to the presidency is not what you do so much when you get into office. I think the public needs to know this. These are issues that concern me, but they don't make me cynical. As a matter of fact, I think probably more of most politicians, and certainly some of the best politicians in Washington, than the general public. No, I'm not cynical.
Well, what's your hope with this book? When you here it is, it's published, it's out, and you've made all these statements about Washington. What do you want to have happen now?
Well, first of all, I'm a reporter, Faith. I'm not a reformer. My job is to tell the story and let people make up their own minds about what they want to do about it. I don't have a cause. I'm not preaching anything. I wrote a long book. I wrote a big book. I've written what I believe to be a very important book. And I didn't think I could write that big a book without giving some answers at the end in the way of what kind of reforms could be taken out. But I am not advocating reforms. That's up to other people. But what I do hope for is that people will look at the way politicians behave more thoughtfully, and the way they behave as voters, because the voters themselves are contributing to the problem. If you're frustrated by stalemated government, and you're going out splitting your ticket, and you're voting for a Republican president and a Democratic member of the House, you are building the kinds of problems that we continue to have on defense spending and deficit and what to do with Social Security and what to do about SDI. If you like that, you're doing exactly the right thing. But if you don't like that, I'm trying to show you that there's something you can do about it.
Thanks so much for talking.
Thank you.
My guest has been the New York Times Washington reporter Hedrick Smith. His new book, The Power Game, How Washington Works, has just been published by Random House. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Yale professor Paul Kennedy. In his new book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, he looks at economic and military conflict from 1500 to 2000. This study reveals patterns that shed light on what might be the fate of the great powers of today. Hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation, and I'm filling in for her. Coming up, I speak with British novelist Faye Weldon. Her works include The Life and Loves of a She-Devil, Down Among the Women, and her latest, The Hearts and Lives of Men. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz samples the choral music of a Renaissance group, the Tallis Scholars. And humorist Alice Kahn shares her own dreams of singing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Today, Attorney General Edwin Meese seemed calm in the face of calls for his resignation. Yesterday, two top Justice Department officials quit, reportedly because of questions about the Attorney General's conduct. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Today, Republican Senator Bob Packwood became the first Republican to call for Meese's resignation, saying the Attorney General has become an embarrassment to the president. Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd called for Meese's resignation, too, saying the Attorney General is, quote, the crown jewel in the sleaze factor. Vice President George Bush, campaigning in Wisconsin, said he is worried about the effectiveness of the Justice Department. These were good people who left, said Bush, but the vice president said it should be up to Meese whether to resign. At the White House, the president's spokesman denied that Mrs. Reagan has urged the president to get rid of Meese, and the president himself remained firm in support of the embattled attorney general.
I have every confidence in him. He's been a friend for 20 years, and I'm not going to comment any further on what is going on there.
As for Meese himself, he vowed not to resign. He said business is going on as usual at the Department of Justice, and he said he expects to name replacements for the men who quit in the near future. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The House has approved a new Contra aid package by a vote of 345-70. The plan would provide $48 million in non-lethal assistance to the Nicaraguan Contras and to children wounded in the seven-year civil war. The bill now goes to the Senate, where it may be considered tomorrow before Congress takes its Easter recess. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted 17-2 today to send the U.S.-Soviet medium-range missile treaty to the Senate floor. The pact eliminating intermediate-range nuclear missiles was signed in December by President Reagan and General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev. It takes a two-thirds vote in the Senate to ratify the treaty. NPR's Ann Garrels reports that Republicans are predicting a floor fight.
Conservative Senator Jesse Helms failed to kill the treaty in committee and has vowed to take his battle to the full Senate. Moderate Republicans support the treaty, but they too are promising a fight. Their problem, a provision added by Senate Democrats. Furious with President Reagan's attempt to reinterpret the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty, Democrats want to ensure presidents will not be able to reinterpret this treaty in the future without Senate approval. Their provision states that administration testimony to the Senate is binding. Senator Richard Lugar has accused Democrats of trying to embarrass the president at the expense of the INF treaty. But Democrats are convinced today's vote indicates Republicans will not jeopardize the treaty over this issue. The treaty is due to reach the Senate floor in mid-April, with ratification expected in time for the June summit in Moscow. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Four Palestinians were killed today and more than 40 wounded in widespread demonstrations on Land Day in Israel's occupied territories. The area remains sealed off by the Israeli military. Today, the government closed down a Palestinian news service. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Israeli police swept into the offices of the Palestine Press Service today and ordered it closed for 6 months. The Arab-owned news agency has been an important source of information during the four-month-long Palestinian uprising, often providing accurate details hours before Israeli military officials confirm them. There was widespread violence on Land Day in the occupied territories. The day commemorates six Arabs killed during protests against Israeli seizures of Arab land. Four Palestinians were shot and killed. The Israeli military spokesman said at least 45 were injured, some with live ammunition, others with tear gas. Land Day passed without incident inside Israel. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos.
Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 20 points to close at 1978.22. Declines led advances 3-2 on volume of 152 million shares. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Tallis Scholars is a group of eight British singers who specialize in unaccompanied Renaissance choral music. This weekend, they're beginning a 12-city, two-week North American tour. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of some of their award-winning, best-selling recordings.
The Tallis Scholars isn't a very exciting name for a vocal group. Yet in their 10-year career under the direction of Peter Phillips, they have grown into one of the most valued early music groups in the world. The problem with most early music vocal groups is that they're too precious. Their image of vocal purity lies beyond anything human. Ensembles sound like pipe organs. Women sound like choir boys. The Tallis Scholars are not exactly exceptions, but at least they come remarkably close to their ideal. Their voices are exquisitely pure. They blend without homogenization. And they're not just making beautiful sounds. The masses and motets they do have a real structural conviction. Without being dramatic in the modern sense, they build to a powerful intensity without apparent effort or affectation. I hadn't actually heard about the Tallis Scholars before I heard about their upcoming American tour. When I heard their recording of John Taverner's Gloria Tibi Trinitas Mass on the radio, I was floored. But they don't just specialize in English music. Their recordings range from the Victoria Requiem Mass and Josquin to Russian liturgical music from the 16th century to the present. Their most popular recording is the Miserere by the 17th century Roman composer Gregorio Allegri, written for performances in the Sistine Chapel during Holy Week. The text is the penitential Ash Wednesday Psalm 51. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness. According unto the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. The Vatican was so possessive about this piece that anyone who copied it risked excommunication. One story is that it reached the outside world when Mozart heard it and transcribed it from memory. It's in five nearly identical sections. The most astonishing passage comes at the end of each repeated section, when the solo treble, Allison Stamp, escapes all earthly bonds and floats down from a transcendent high sea like a rain of tender mercies. The Talus scholars capture perfectly the solemn melancholy of the Miserere. Even the reverberant ambience of Oxford's Merton College Chapel, where this was recorded, is perfect. This recording also includes Palestrina's Mass in memory of Pope Marcellus II, who had died the year before, in 1655, after a three-week reign, and the angelically sweet and eloquent Vox Patris Celestis, written during the reign of Queen Mary by the obscure English composer William Mundy. I haven't heard all the recordings of the Talus scholars yet, but so far nothing has been a disappointment.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed recordings by the Talus scholars featuring the music of Josquin, Allegri, and Mundy, all on the group's own record label, Gimmel. The Talus Scholars Tour will include performances in Los Angeles, Seattle, Evanston, Illinois, Boston, New York, and Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This is Fresh Air. My guest is British fiction writer Faye Weldon. She's best known in this country for her novel The Life and Loves of a She-Devil, which was adapted for television. Her new book is called The Hearts and Lives of Men, and it's written as a fable. In his New York Times review, James Wilcox praised Weldon's narrative skill and said, "Her deft use of irony leaves plenty of room for the heartfelt emotions, even the frank sentimentality, that more cautious writers might shy away from." Weldon received degrees in economics and psychology and started her writing career in advertising. I asked her why she turned to fiction.
I had something to say, I suppose, so it seemed to me time to say it. I didn't set out to be a writer at all, but I've been writing for about 20 years, I suppose, now, and I began sort of with the women's movement, not because of it, but the pressures of women, on women were such that you realised there was just an enormous amount to be said. Nobody was saying it, and I should do it. So I did it.
Yeah. Did you ever think of it as a way to get your concept of people's psychology to the world?
Yes, I think. Well, I think I needed to work it out for myself before I could hand it on. But yes, that's part of it. I believe, in quotes, that self-understanding is what we're all about, or that's what we should be aiming for, almost, rather than happiness, which is how most people would put the same thing.
You know, I noticed that so many of your characters are risk takers. Are you that way too?
Yes, I think, well, other people seem to think I am. I don't think so. It just seems to me I do what's in front of my nose, but they stand around sometimes wondering how I had the nerve to do it, and then I get frightened myself, but usually after I've done it.
One thing you do in The Hearts and Lives of Men is talk right to us as readers. Your narrator opens the book by saying, "Reader, I'm going to tell you the story of Clifford, Helen, and Little Nell." And it's a lot like Dickens to me, but most writers today don't try that style. I wonder why.
I think you've got to have an enormous self-confidence and nerve and say, I mean, well, here I am. I'm writing this book. In a way, you know who I am by now. I know who you are. Let's not pretend. I mean, I'm not some authorial god who nobody knows about working up in some ivory tower. I am me. You have seen me on television or heard me on radio or seen me at the school gate picking up the kids. So what is this pretense all about? I mean, I don't think I'll do it again, but it's one way of doing a novel, is being somehow in there with the reader, almost telling the reader what to think and feel, and when they're allowed to disagree with me and and they're not.
Well, did you write Hearts and Lives the same way you wrote the rest of your books?
No, not at all, you see. It's kind of accidental novel. It started out as a serial in a woman's magazine written week by week, for episode by episode, for the messenger waiting at the door on his motorbike to carry off to the printers. But, you know, it was the back of this woman's magazine, and I didn't think anybody would notice, really, and I never seemed to get any response from the readers, and only the girls in the office seemed to be really interested in it, so I just wrote it for them, really.
You mean you never knew what would happen each week?
No, I didn't. I didn't know how many episodes it was going to go on. I did ask if I could have 4 weeks' notice, please, before I had to draw it to an end. So it always had to be sort of so constructed, both that you could carry it on and that you could wrap up all these strands at the end, and that it made perfect sense, sort of episode by episode. And I would write little things up the top, the now read on bits, the story so far. And I really love doing those, and I would say things like, well, now we're on to episode 32, but do not fear, reader, you can still join in. This is the story to date. And that was great. And then, of course, when it turned into a novel, I had to take all those bits out, which I was rather sorry about, because I thought they were rather good.
Well, how did you make up your mind about what would happen next?
Well, I just thought it up, didn't I, on the train, usually, on the way in. And then you get a bit bored with it yourself, so something amazing would happen, liven it all up. And, I mean, it reads well for that reason, I think, because both I'd got to be very inventive and yet sort of controlled at the same time. And I think readers actually respond to this kind of sort of instant energy, sort of instant literary energy, if you like.
This is a book about how men and women get along with each other. And I noticed a reviewer or two saying they thought it would make some men mad.
Well, yes, I expect so, but it would make some women mad too, because the women don't get along with the men too well, and they don't come out of it particularly well either. But I think women are accustomed in fiction to being seen as rather despicable, idle creatures, and just men aren't used to it, but they'll get used to it.
Now, Life and Loves of a She-Devil, your book was done on television by the BBC originally, and then played here in the United States. How did that feel to you, to see your book come alive that way?
Well, I've been writing television for a long time, and I was very gratified to see it done so well, in fact. There are always problems in adaptation, but I think they were terrific. I think the casting was amazing. I think their concentration on this story was extraordinary. You've got such an enormous audience, such a wide spectrum of people on TV, that in a way it needs to be written really quite simply. People pick up out of it what they will. You reach millions and millions of people through television.
Do you like that better?
Yes, you reach them in a different way. In television, the plot has to carry the meaning and the significance. People, the viewer has to be moved sufficiently by the kind of moral dilemmas they see on the screen to apply them back to their own lives. I mean, that is if you're writing television drama properly. In novels, I mean, as in The Hearts and Lives of Men, you can talk to them direct. You can put things to them at length and explain the subtleties of situations almost. So it's easier to write novels, but more responsibility.
You said that you're doing this because you want to be listened to. Do you feel famous?
No. No, I don't, because I don't think I've got it right yet. When I say I want to be listened to, in a way, it's not that I think I'm right, therefore I ought to be listened to. It's I wish to put things to people so that they can almost fight back or come to their own conclusions. I mean, I don't want to tell them what to think. I want them to think. That's all.
I end up thinking about the forces of good and evil in the world when I read your stories. Are you obsessed with that yourself?
I don't think I'm obsessed with it. I feel very conscious that it works through us. I mean, yeah, it's a very kind of old tradition in human beliefs that there are that of if you like, God and the devil, and it seems to strike some chord in the human heart that these things exist, or this is how we interpret them.
Are you any closer to figuring out why there's so much evil in the world?
Well, I think it is because of our inability to recognize it from in ourselves. I think, and this is what I hope my books do, they demonstrate, at least I hope they demonstrate, that we are all partly good and partly bad. It is not I am good, the others are all bad, but I am partly good, partly bad, and I will do what I can to understand and control the bad without being sort of losing my self-confidence entirely. It's very difficult for people to do. I mean, I go around wishing that I could meet a really bad somebody who said I am a bad person, but I never do. So, I conclude from that we're all mixed, and if we can recognize this, we're in a much better state to control it.
Faye Weldon's new book is titled The Hearts and Lives of Men. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel to find out what's going on. Are you there, Robert?
I am. How are you, Faith?
I'm fine.
Today we're going to be following events at the Justice Department. You know, yesterday there were several high officials of the Justice Department who resigned. Nina Totenberg is looking at the big question, will the Attorney General follow suit? And she'll fill us in on whatever happened on that front today. Also, news from the Israeli-occupied territories. It is Land Day. That's an annual protest event for Palestinians on the West Bank and in Gaza. The Israelis sealed off the territories in anticipation of it. News from there and also from Panama.
Sounds good. Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Fantasies. We all have them. Today, humorist Alice Kahn shares one of hers.
In my mind, I'm Alicia L'Amour, the recluse chanteuse. I saunter up to the piano in my simple black strapless gown and slowly peel my elbow-length gloves. A rhinestone bracelet dangles from my wrist. My fox wrap falls to the floor as I begin to play Satin Doll. Then, I'm Patti Page singing Tennessee Waltz. Segue into Billie Holiday singing I Cover the Waterfront, into Barbara Streisand singing the slowest, saddest Happy Days Are Here Again you ever heard. Then I'm Linda Ronstadt singing Blue Bayou in that opera singer with gallstones voice. In the real world, the unjust world, I'm a woman in a sweatshirt who can't carry a tune. But in the musical world where dreams come true, I'm Tina Turner in 2 feet of skirt and 10 feet of legs singing Proud Mary, Keep on Burning. My kids scream out, "Oh no, Mom, please don't sing." My husband forces them to leave the room so the performance can continue. He's learned through time that a medley beats an ugly female mood swing any day. I've always loved singing and playing the piano. Unfortunately, it's my curse to have been given a pretty bad voice, a tone-deaf ear, and no sense of rhythm. As a child insomniac, I would wait until everyone was asleep, and then at midnight take out my Hit Parader magazines and sing Mockingbird Hill, or If I Knew You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked a Cake, or The Wheel of Fortune until the wee small hours of the morning. My bedroom became the Club Trocadero, where ladies with gardenia corsages and men with thin sterling cigarette cases ate chili con carne and sipped sparkling champagne. Later, after I took piano lessons, I discovered that when my parents were fighting, music was my friend. I would sit there banging the ivories until they stopped. I really believed my music had charms. This was confirmed when I worked as a volunteer at a free clinic in the 60s. Maybe I couldn't bring down the house with my skills, but I could bring down an acid freakout like nobody's business. I just relax and let my fingers do the dancing. And still today, when I'm sad, if I can just get to that piano, I can save my soul. Sometimes I really am Janis singing Take a Little Piece of My Heart. And sometimes I'm Frankie singing Why Do Fools Fall in Love so sweetly that you'd swear the whole world was 14 years old. But somehow, I'm never, ever Little Richard, no matter how hard I try. My imagination has its limits. A few years ago, I tried to give my mailman, George C. George, a song and dance for Christmas. As he approached my porch, I came out singing and tap dancing. It's Mr. George C. George, the mailman, bringing me letters and maybe presents and maybe some money. He ran away as if he'd been attacked by a yelping dog. But I suppose that has always been the goal of Alicia L'Amour, a woman in her music, to make the world go away.
Alice Kahn is a syndicated columnist based in Berkeley, California. Here's a look at the next fresh air. On the next show, I'll talk with classical guitarist David Tannenbaum. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review new albums by country singers George Strait and Steve Warner. And film critic Stephen Schiff will talk about Biloxi Blues, the film adaptation of Neil Simon's hit Broadway play. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. Thank you. This is NPR, National Public Radio.